MyMac Podcast number 111 is live on the air.
It's the Year in Review with Chad Perry, Guy Searle, and Tim Robertson.
The next generation of radio. It's the MyMac.com Podcast.
And what a year it's been. 2006 has been a pretty good year for MyMac.com, and welcome to the show. I am Tim Robertson.
I'm here. I'm Chad Perry.
And Guy Searle is joining us via Skype. Hi, Guy.
Hey, guys. How's it going?
Oh, it's... If it was going any better, Guy, I would be you. That's what I'm saying.
Yes, life is good over here at the Searle household.
You know what I'm saying? Hey, I heard you got a new computer. What's up with that?
Yeah, I did. Over Christmas, I pretty much bought my own Christmas gift. It was a 24-inch iMac, heavily discounted by my mother-in-law and my wife.
Ho, ho, ho.
Ho, ho, ho.
So we can't do any mother-in-law jokes because it doesn't apply to Guy. It doesn't apply to me either, actually.
Yeah. She's a wonderful, wonderful woman.
You notice Chad didn't say it didn't apply to him. Yeah. He's like, I ain't going there. My wife might listen to this someday.
Well, my mother-in-law's in her 70s, and of course, she doesn't even understand computers and doesn't have any desire to. So
the gifts have been given, open, everybody's happy. You know, it's really hard to buy gifts for techno geeks like us, isn't it? I think that's probably very difficult. I would prefer that people don't buy me tech gifts.
Really?
Well, what are they going to buy me, an iPod? I got an iPod.
Well, what I normally ask for is just like books. I ask for books. I ask for stuff little things.
Yeah,
stuff that I'd think, God, be nice to have, but I just don't.
You're not going to go out and spend your own. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Well, my wife has the same. She's been asking me for the last couple of weeks what I wanted for Christmas. And, you know, I wanted to say a new computer, but I just felt that was like a bit much. So finally, I said, well, you know what I could use? I could use a new computer table. So we looked around a bit, didn't really find anything that was really suitable. And we ended up going to this mall called Pentagon City here in Virginia. And they just happened to have an Apple store there. And while we were there, we were looking around, and I saw the sheer blissed goodness of the 24-inch iMac and started playing with it. And she was like, was that what you really want? And it was like, yeah.
Yes, please.
I want one, please. So, plus I was lucky. They had, excuse me, they had two open box Macs, one with wireless keyboard and mouse and one without. And I chose the one without, and it was $1,650.
Wow, that's a heck of a price.
Yep.
I tell you what, I like that 24-inch.
Oh, yeah.
That's
How do you like having all that screen acreage there, Guy?
It's amazing. I've never had a monitor this big in my life, and sometimes as I'm mousing around on it, it's like, oh, where did it go? I've lost something here. There's just too much real estate to look at, and that's a nice problem.
Where's my cursor? I've had that problem. Where is that? You got to shake it real fast. Oh, there it is. How'd it get way up there, man? So, 2006 is almost over, and on today's show, we're going to look back at the top stories that we feel were the top stories of 2006.
Mm-hmm.
We're also going to look a little bit into the future. We don't have long to wait to find out what 2007 holds for Mac users, Macworld Expo.
At least in the beginning of 2007.
Right, yeah. Macworld Expo is right around the corner. In fact, in less than 2 weeks... I'll be in San Francisco, and Guy will be in San Francisco, and
yep.
Chad will be going through the drudgery of everyday life here back in Michigan.
Here, here.
Well, I'm just hoping.
He kind of had this like, yeah, I know.
Okay.
I can't contain the excitement.
So
I'm hoping that the weather's going to hold up.
San Francisco, come on.
Oh, I'm not talking about San Francisco. I'm talking about here in Virginia. With the job I have had for a number of years now with the government, I had a job. I was going to redo a particular office in Honolulu, Hawaii, and the very first time I was going to go there, it was an early morning flight. I got to National Airport here in Washington, D.C., and the snow was just coming down like crazy, and they ended up canceling all the flights that morning. They actually closed down the government that morning.
Fascinating.
Well, I ended up not being able to go until the next week.
That sucks.
It does.
So anyways, about Macintosh again.
Oh, are we talking about Macs?
Yeah. Not that your missives at the airport weren't interesting, but...
Oh, I'm not allowed to go on a tangent. I understand. Okay, let me write that down.
So for MyMac.com, it was a pretty banner year. We had the first full year of a lot of new writers at MyMac, Bakari, Donnie.
David Cohen.
The podcast expanded to two podcasts until it went back to one podcast, simply because I think it works better as one.
Yep.
Guy flew up from Virginia, and we did a live broadcast from the Apple Store in Grand Rapids, Michigan.
Podcast man, that was a lot of fun.
That was a lot of fun. Some nice pictures online to...
wish I felt better.
Yeah, yeah. A lot of people... You know, it's funny. The people that were there and the people that listened to that particular podcast have no idea how under the weather Guy really was.
I was very, very sick.
I still have the spray for your throat in my car.
Well, make sure you bring it to San Francisco.
So, but the year
can't
started...
Can't find it anywhere else.
Just like next year, the year started in January of 2006. I hear it's going to do the same thing in 2007.
Mm.
But, you know, don't quote me on that.
All right.
So what was the big story in January, Guy?
Well, I think the big story was the rollout of the Intel Macs.
I agree.
Yeah, yep. At the 2006 Macworld Expo, and of course the first ones out of the chute were the iMacs, the 17 and 20 inch iMacs, and the 15 inch MacBook Pros.
I would probably say that would be the number one story of the year in the Mac universe. I don't think anything else was as significant, at least for the average Mac user and Apple as a company, as the release of the Intel iMacs.
Yep.
Remember, exactly a year ago today, as we record this, there were no Intel Macs. We knew they were coming. Steve Jobs had announced at the Worldwide Developers Conference.
Mm-hmm.
And six months later,
the first Intel iMac, and here we are, 12 months later, and the entire product line has been switched over to the Intel platform.
Every single stinking
and
one of them.
Really, not only the product line, but so many developers made the switch over to universal binaries as
pretty
well.
Pretty quickly.
Pretty quickly, yeah.
Yeah.
And well, they had actually said at the rollout, or at the...
WWDC.
Yeah, that it was relatively simple for most people to turn them into universal binaries.
Well, if they had used Apple's coding software.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And a lot
Which
of companies
obviously
didn't.
Adobe did not.
Well, in all fairness, though, and Adobe obviously knew that the switch to Intel was coming up before anybody else at the Worldwide Developers Conference knew. I mean, that's just too big of a partner for them not to have had some advance warning. But in all fairness to Adobe, it's not easy to rewrite an application of the sophistication of Photoshop Illustrator,
right?
InDesign. Mm-hmm. I mean, you're talking about major, major programs that they can't just flip a switch and now it's running natively on Intel.
Yeah, essentially you're looking at iLife for Experts converted over, so.
Yeah. So, but beyond that, beyond the switch to Intel, I think the other big story, and I don't think a lot of people really think about this too much, is Rosetta.
Rosetta is
as important to Apple as the switch to Intel itself was, simply because had Rosetta been buggy and didn't work, a lot of people would not have made the switch to Intel as fast as they did.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they did kind of the same thing when they were switching from the old Motorola 68000 processors to the PowerPC.
Yeah, but the applications today are much more sophisticated, much more complex, and much larger than it was back in those days.
Well, plus, all the hardware is a lot faster,
right,
too.
Exactly. But look at, I mean, it was a seamless migration for the most part. There was a couple hiccups here and there. But for the most part, it was a pretty painless
exploding
migration.
Laptop, excuse me.
Yeah. It's, I think it's amazing that Rosetta worked as well as it did. Yes, Photoshop isn't as fast in Rosetta on an Intel machine, but you know what? It still works.
Yep.
And it's still fast. I mean, you're talking, you know, if you've got a Mac Pro, you're looking at a, you know, two dual core Xeon chips.
Yes.
And even if you have an iMac or a Mac Mini or one of the new MacBooks, you've got a Core 2 Duo processor there, running it over, for the most part, 2 gigahertz.
And it's going to be fast.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So I think the other story of January for Mac users was that Disney bought Pixar.
Yeah, yep. All stock deal.
Yeah, an all stock deal, which made Steve Jobs a richer man.
He's now Disney's biggest stockholder.
Yes. So February rolls around, and what comes out in February?
Well, in February, we have the new Mac Minis going from the G4 to two models, one with a 1.5 gigahertz core solo and another model with a 1.67 core duo.
Price jumped $100 across the line in the Mac Minis. Form factor stayed exactly the same. Mm-hmm. And I know Ford Motor Company bought a whole lot. You see a lot of Mac Minis at the Ford Motor Company in their factories.
Really?
Yeah, I just read a newspaper article about that.
Hmm. Well, are they using them? Are they using them? You know, on the lines, or yes, is it mostly administrative?
No, it's on the line. They're in charge of a lot of automated processes and stuff like that. I find that pretty interesting.
Yeah, that's cool.
Not a whole lot else happened in February, which is probably because Macworld Expo happened in the beginning of January, and so there was so many new product announcement that February, March, April are usually kind of taking a deep breath and recuperating.
And well, February was a lot about trying to get your hands on an Intel Mac to start playing with it. So
yeah, March kind of started the beginning of what's a huge trend in the Mac world now.
Yep.
And that's virtualization. Running Windows applications and Windows OS itself natively or in virtualization on your Macintosh. And there was a contest, wasn't there, guys?
I was going to say, remember, it wasn't Apple that originally came out with the first solution.
Well, you knew Apple was working on a solution.
Oh, yeah.
Because there was that contest. Users donated money, and the first person who got Windows to boot on a MacBook Pro
and could actually publish the application and have somebody else do it.
Verify.
Right. They had to show their process.
They got $13,000, and it's somebody did it.
My old math teacher, you got to show your work.
And they did, and it worked. And 2 weeks after that, I don't even think it was 2 weeks. It was the boot camp comes out.
Yeah, it was about 2 weeks after that when Apple announced boot camp in April.
Yeah, that was the end of March when the $13,000 was awarded, and then April comes out. And, well, not really a bop-bop. I mean, when you think about it, one guy got it to work publicly before Apple released their solution and pocketed $13,000 for it.
True. But if he was going to make any more money off it, off of giving the instructions on how to do it.
Well, if he gave the instructions, I mean, that's kind of giving away. And he didn't do it for free. He got money for it.
Could you imagine what would have happened if Apple had come out with Boot Camp before this contest had been over?
I've often wondered if Apple held back.
Just to let the contest complete
itself. Yeah, because that would have been some bad blood.
Yeah.
Especially they were getting a lot of publicity.
Oh, absolutely.
And from not so much from the street, but from from the technophiles out there. You know, everybody knew about it.
Also in April, Boot Camp wasn't the only solution released to run Windows on your Mac.
Yep, the beta for Parallels was released.
And Parallels, obviously, is a virtual machine on your Macintosh, and that's one of the companies, I think, at least in the Mac world, I think they're probably Mac Company of the Year this year.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they constantly updated that program.
Well, now it's still in beta, isn't it?
Isn't it
still in beta?
Chad, do you need a Kleenex?
Yes, I do.
Oh, okay. Three words. He's pantomiming. No, it was released. There's a new version in beta now, that... looks pretty cool.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it runs Windows applications right alongside.
Yeah, and I think David Mac Cohen did a little brief review of it in Fenestration.
Yep.
That and there's another virtualization.
Yeah, VMware coming out.
Right.
And it does many of the same. You can have multiple operating systems on that as well. So, the time for Mac users to only be able to run one OS on their computer, I'm sorry to say, or I'm happy to say, is long since over.
Yep.
And it's not just Apple providing the solutions.
Mm-hmm.
Well, isn't there third parties.
Isn't there one other company that's coming out with some software that uses Wine where you don't even need Windows?
That's right, yeah. You know, it was
that's going to be... That'll be a big tipping point.
That's
right. If they can come out with something that
works
75%, it doesn't even have to run everything, but if it runs 75% of the Windows software out there and you don't need Windows, of course, probably the first thing that will happen is that, MS will change something in Windows so that it doesn't work anymore, but it'll still work for the older applications.
Yeah, but the whole point of that is you don't need Windows to run the applications with that It will simply run Windows applications in the Mac OS. So we'll see how that comes out. It's still vaporware at this point. So.
Right.
And that will probably be a story for 2007.
Well, there's one other story that happened in April.
Well, but it was almost a non-story, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, pretty much, because there was no announcement, at least from Apple, of any kind.
But well, I think everybody was expecting some big product announcement to coattail with it.
And the big event was obviously the 30th anniversary of Apple forming as a company.
Mm-hmm.
And nothing happened. Everybody was excited. Ooh, it's going to be a new iPod release. You watch a new type of Mac or something's going to happen.
30th anniversary
and
Mac?
Then, nothing.
Yeah, 30th anniversary, 30th anniversary iPhone.
We want to take a second to thank our sponsor, Small Dog Electronics.
Yep.
They just recently went through their 10-year anniversary and opened their second store, so they're doing quite well. They're the
excellent.
I believe I heard they're the third largest Mac reseller, independent Mac reseller, in the world. So that's
now, are they fabulous. In Michigan?
Nope. No, they're in
Vermont.
Vermont, that's correct.
Ah, okay.
So thank you very much, Small Dog Electronics. If you're looking for Macs, Mac hardware, Mac software, looking for
RAM,
iPods,
hard drives,
printers,
accessories,
digital cameras, check out smalldog.com.
And tell them that My Mac sent you.
May. I'm going to let you guys keep going for a second here. I will be right back to the microphone, but talk about May.
Ah, so what happened in May, Guy?
Well, in May, we had more Intel-based Macs come out. The MacBooks to replace the G4-based iBooks were released. There were two models in two colors.
That was
white
a big deal.
And black. Yeah, it was a big deal because, you know, they were getting more of their consumer stuff out there.
Mm-hmm.
And they were very reasonably priced. You had the white 1.83 gigahertz Core Duo with the combo drive that was about $1,100. The slightly updated, or upgraded, I should say, white 2 gigahertz Core Duo with the super drive was $200 more. But the really weird thing was the black 2 gigahertz Core Duo had a slightly larger hard drive and the super drive for $1,499. Now, the weird thing about this was you could actually update a white MacBook to the exact identical specifications, and it was $150 less than the black one.
Yeah.
That's weird.
Yeah, but, you know, I think we all kind of figured it was all about the style on this one. I mean, when's the last time that Apple ever put out any sort of computer in black other than the 20th anniversary Macintosh?
Well, the old G3 PowerBooks were black.
Oh, you're right. I forgot all about those. Because Tim used to have one. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, I had a, what was it? I had a 500 megahertz G3 Pismo.
Mm-hmm.
That was, I mean, up until I got my iBook, it was a great machine. I think there was a poll taken some time ago where they were asking, you know, what your favorite Apple laptop was, and I think the Pismo came out on top.
I'm not surprised. That was a good machine. I actually had a Lombard, not a Pismo.
Mm-hmm.
Very, very similar.
Yeah, you know, it was the
Wall
generation
Street,
right before.
Right, the Wall Street, which was the first PowerBook with USB ports.
Yep.
The Lombard and the Pismo, I mean, it was just a great design. You had these little levers where you could pop out the batteries, you could pop out the CD-ROM, and if you wanted to put either like another battery or another hard drive in, it was just you just plugged it right in and it just worked.
So what month are we up to now?
We are up to June.
June, and that's when an ongoing story is still happening, and that's when the stock scandal broke. Mm-hmm. And we still don't know what the ramifications of that's going to be. And hopefully Apple and us, we won't lose Steve Jobs as the CEO of Apple. But
I don't think that's going to happen.
I don't either.
You know, I know a lot of Apple haters out there. And
are hoping.
Anyone who goes to tech sites where there's lots of user-generated replies or comments, you know, all the Apple haters, oh, you know, Steve Jobs is getting ready to go to iJail. You know, make sure he doesn't drop the iSoap. And, you know, I mean, just all this mm-hmm. stupid crap.
Yep. I'll just say let's let the courts handle it. Let's let
right.
I mean, you know,
mm-hmm. as yeah, Mac like we have any choice.
Yeah, like as Mac users, there's really no need to dwell on it. I don't think we don't know what happened. We, you know, I don't think it's a big deal yet.
Not yet.
Intel announced the release of the Core 2 dual processors in July, and of course, all the Mac users started going, hey, maybe we're going to get those in our machines, and we did.
Yep, we did.
August. August was a pretty big month for Apple.
Oh, it was huge. You had the Intel-based Mac Pro towers replacing the G5s. And, you know, from the outside, you wouldn't really see any difference. But, I mean, all you had to do was just lower that side door. And, yeah, you know, all of the special cooling that they needed for those dual and quad G5 microprocessors were taken up with space for 4 SATA drives and 16 gigs of RAM and you know, I mean, it's really if you can afford it, it's an amazing machine.
I seem to remember someone calling it the Mac Pro long before Apple called it the Mac Pro, Chad.
Ooh.
That's what we were calling it for almost the whole year up until that point, isn't it?
Yeah.
Because once they came out with the MacBook Pro, which was the PowerBook, we went, so we kind of figured it's the Mac Pro, and I still think that's probably a good name.
Yeah,
I like the Mac Pro moniker. It works real well for Apple. Apple also released the X-Serves that month.
Using the same Xeon chips.
Yeah, but what's probably, at least for most Mac users, the biggest impact, we got to see the preview of the next version of the Mac OS once again, and that's Mac OS 10.5.
Correct.
Yeah.
Leopard. I'm getting a little sick of the cat names, though.
I know.
Time to change it up, I hope.
Well, I have a feeling they're with us until we hit OS X 11.
Yep. Apple also settled their lawsuit with Creative Technologies, and Creative Technologies turned around and became...
$1 million.
They also turned around and became an iPod supplier... third-party supplier.
Yeah. Yeah, an authorized... There's a term for it. I can't think of what it is.
Yeah, but they make iPod stuff now. Imagine how that works. September, the iMacs were updated with the Intel Core 2 Duo processors, and everybody was very happy. Is that what's sitting in your Mac, Guy?
Yes, it is. As a matter of fact, that was that same month was when the 24-inch behemoth iMacs were released, and I can recall having some conversations... back then saying, oh, they'll never sell these. They're too big. They're too expensive. And, you know, if you look back at some of my posts, I was saying nonsense like that. And here I am with one.
Well, that was also the month that you flew up here for the podcast.
Yes, it is.
And so I remember Guy and I and Chad, the first day that we went up there to Grand Rapids, we all looked at that 24-inch iMac and went,
ooh. Nice.
That's sweet.
Also in the same month, and Guy and I talked about this on that 100th podcast, Apple started selling full-length movies from Disney in the iTunes Music Store, and unfortunately, it's still only Disney movies all these months later. I mean, you know, I got a feeling we're going to see some kind of an announcement of other movie studios joining with Apple to sell movies in the iTunes Music Store at the Expo.
Well, especially now that Christmas is over, and you know, everyone who's going to buy DVDs as Christmas presents has done so. So now it's pretty safe.
And I think with the launch of the ITV device, you're also going to have to have some studios signing up.
There needs to be more content.
Yep.
I mean, Pirates of the Caribbean has been like the top movie in iTunes for 6 months now. And come on. It is a good movie, don't get me wrong. But Apple needs more media partners for the iTunes movie store, if you will. It has to happen. It has to happen soon.
Oh, it will. Like I was saying, I think everybody, the other major studios, they're watching Disney making all this cash off of iTunes, and they want to get in, but they didn't want to tick off their retail partners, the Walmarts and the Targets and, you know, whatnot. So I think they were just basically waiting until after Christmas, and I think there's going to be a slew of announcements of studios signing up in the month of January.
Steve Jobs also showed off the ITV. Of course, that's not going to be the actual name of the product when it's released, but that's what we've lovingly come to call it, the ITV, beaming movies and music from your Mac to your living room wirelessly. And
hopefully it does more than that.
Yeah, price point is what, $299?
That's what he's talking.
Yeah, that's what they said, $299.
We'll see. The second generation of the iPod Nanos were released. They were thinner. They had multiple colors. They were larger in capacity, and I still kind of want one, even though I don't need one.
Because they look like mini minis.
They're just cool. And also shuffles.
I bought Tracy a 4 gigabyte green Nano.
Awesome. I bought the 11 and the 12-year-old girls in my family, my daughters, shuffles.
Cool.
And they're very pleased with them.
As long as they don't lose them.
They're very, very happy. Well, we've had that discussion with
them. Had them go through the wash.
October saw the 5th anniversary of the iPod. It's amazing it's been around 5 years. And as I like to remind people, when it first came out in October of 2001, I said it was a stupid idea and that Sony's going to get into the market and crush Apple. And I was absolutely right. Wait a minute.
Excuse me?
No, I wasn't. Yeah.
iPod, Sony's getting ready to sell Zunes.
Yep. Also, Apple released the iPod Red.
As part of the Project Red, which I think, 10% of the sale goes to charity.
It was also in October at the Mac show in, was it England? No.
Yep.
Yeah,
London.
That's right. The Greenpeace kind of made asses of themselves and got kicked out of their expo. Mm-hmm. And
I'm shocked.
Yeah, who knew that? Adobe also released Sound Booth, which is an audio application. And the funny thing is it only runs on Intel Macs. It will not run on PowerPC Macs.
Which kind of makes me wonder whether CS3 will run on PowerPC Max.
Oh, of course it will. Absolutely. In fact, the beta of Adobe Photoshop CS3 has been released, and it does run on PowerPC. That would be monumentally stupid on their part.
It's too early.
From someone that works in an industry that sees creative people all the time, the majority of said people are on Macs, and the majority of those Macs are still
PowerPC.
There's no way that Adobe would slit their own throat and kill the cash cow. No, it's not going to happen. Because, quite honestly, because CS3 hasn't been released yet, most design studios have not upgraded to the Intel Macs.
Because
they need Photoshop, they need Illustrator to run as fast as it possibly can, because time is money. So.
Yep.
What else happened in November? I think that was pretty much it.
Well, we were talking about October.
October, I'm sorry. That was
in November then.
Yep, November.
Oh, MacBook Pros upgraded to Core 2 Duos.
Yep, and then the following month, the MacBooks were also upgraded to the Core 2 Duos in November. The Zune Music Player came out.
And, the iPod killer released.
Yeah, and it absolutely crushed the iPod. Apple's on the verge of bankruptcy now because Microsoft
is
so brilliant. With the Zune. It's such a revolution.
Well, and I think the Zune was responsible for the 65% decline in iPod.
Absolutely.
Or in iTunes Music Store sales
over the years. Zune juggernaut is everywhere, and we are but peons in its myth.
Welcome to the social, pal.
The great and who doesn't monolith.
And who doesn't like to squirt?
Yeah, everyone likes squirting. In December, really nothing. Not too much in December, but, you know, this is still December, and I guess something could happen tomorrow, although I doubt it. But realistically, December is leading up to the Macworld Expo in less than 2 weeks in San Francisco. So that was the big stories of 2006.
Yay!
I ask you guys, name two things you think is the biggest thing that happened in this last year. We'll start with you, Chad.
Oh, by all means, it was the Intel Macs, I think. Because I remember in 2005 when we were speculating about whether it would happen, and then, of course, it would happen, and then, of course, how well would it happen? How smoothly would it occur? And I think, you know, it's just a well-executed, well-planned product rollout.
So that's all the way one. Around. That's your number one.
Yeah.
What's your number two?
I think when we had the interview with Gil Amelio, that was probably.
Yeah, I'd have to agree with you there. That was a big moment for our podcast and for our website to be able to sit down and speak with an ex-CEO of Apple Computer, the guy who brought Steve Jobs back into the fold, the guy who started the iMac project, even though he doesn't get credit for it.
The guy who predicted that Steve Jobs would take over Disney.
Yeah. And, you know, if you read his book.
He does say it at the end. Yeah.
I think his name is Gil Nostradamus Emilio.
Oh,
I could be mistaken on that. What about you, Guy? What's the two big stories for you?
Well, I think the absolute biggest story is me joining the podcast.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I think that was more important than almost anything else that we've done.
And he brought the hordes of, teen girls to the show. Following, it's like Beatlemania, but we call it Guy Mania.
Mm-hmm. That's right, because I'm so scary good looking.
Well, plus the whole widget segment, you know, you did get quite a cult following with that. So
that's right.
Who doesn't like widgets?
That's right.
I think that in my mind, the biggest story as far as Apple goes was iTunes 7 and selling movies.
Really?
Yeah, I think in the long run that because I mean Apple is positioning themselves to be the center of everyone that, you know, gets into Apple, be the center of their digital content universe. And these are really just the first baby steps. Apple typically takes their time. They don't just put a lot of crap out and see what sticks. And, you know, I'm thinking that the ITV is going to be a lot more than what has been shown so far.
I agree with you. I think that is definitely one of the top stories. I don't think we've seen the full ramifications of them selling
movies
yet.
Not yet.
Apple doesn't make money when they sell movies. They don't make money when they sell music.
It's not a matter of them making money selling the content.
That's
it's,
right.
It's getting you to buy their hardware.
That's right. They're acting as the distribution means, and they're also selling the hardware is where they're making the money. That's why iPods are so popular. That's why the ITV project may be so popular.
And it's why all those people that keep saying, why doesn't Apple just release OS X for PCs? It'll never happen.
So that's
Apple makes money on hardware.
So that's one. What's your second big one?
Ooh, second big one. Other than the entire line going to Core Duo and Intel Xeon processors, it's really been kind of I won't say an off year, but I think that there hasn't been anything really, really huge that Apple has done beyond delivering movies and all the Intel Macs. There's, you know, everything else is still, well, come on, let's wait and see what happens in January.
I would have to go with the switch to Intel is probably the biggest story as far as Apple is concerned. When they changed their entire product line within 12 months.
And it's less been, than 12
and,
months.
And it's been pretty much hiccup-free. Mm-hmm. Very, very, very impressive.
Yep.
Beyond that, I think the second biggest story is how easy it's become for Mac users to run Windows. In Windows applications natively on the Mac. That's going to have the biggest ramifications from the software side of business. Because now anybody who has been historically a PC user and has a legacy of PC software that they need to run can now seriously look at any Macintosh that is being sold today. Any Mac. Mm-hmm. From the Mac Mini, the MacBook Pro, the iMac, the Mac Pro, any of those mm-hmm. can run. When even the Mac Mini, tiny little computer that can fit in your hand, can run Microsoft Windows.
Yep.
Either natively via boot camp or virtualization through Parallels or VMware or whoever knows what's going to come out in the future.
Mm-hmm. Well, so you know, I disagree. I disagree slightly. I think that Apple came out. You know, once they decided they were going to go Intel, they decided that. You know, they would allow, and really it was up to Apple, they were going to allow people to use Windows on the PC, and I think that's the hook. They're using, you know, other than really, really specialized software that isn't available on any other platform besides Windows, almost every other piece of software that's out there has a Mac equivalent.
Yeah, but so you got to realize, we know that as Mac pundits, but
right,
the average PC user did not know that. They were not comfortable even thinking of switching to Apple because the comfort level of, I know how to use these applications, I've got my pictures on this computer, they didn't realize how easy that would be. And now that it's out there in public knowledge that, oh yeah, by the way, Macs can run PC software and Microsoft Windows as well, that brought a comfort level to switchers that was never there before.
Yep.
See, that's the hook.
Well, yeah, but that goes to what I was saying, that's why it's... To me, the second biggest story, the ability to run natively and in virtualization Windows on the Mac is, it's not as big as the switch to Intel, but it's right there. And I think those two are by far the biggest, and that's why I said Parallels as a company has to be looked at. I mean, nobody even knew who they were a year ago from today. A year ago, Parallels, someone said, what about Parallels as a company? We have no idea what they're talking about. Just 12 months later, this is a huge company on the Mac scene.
Mm-hmm.
Huge. So running Windows on the Mac is my number two pick. And I would disagree with Guy, and I would say this has pretty much been a banner year for Apple and what they've accomplished. It's huge. I can't remember a year that's been more exciting as a Mac user. But on a personal level, I would say doing our 100th show at in Grand Rapids in the Apple Store with Guy, and the night before when Chad and I went out there and picked up Guy, and having people like John Farr send us that song for the show. That our 100th
Rick Stringer
podcast,
taking pictures.
That's right. Mm-hmm. That 100th podcast was really, really big. It was a milestone for us. I mean, MyMac.com, we're going into our 13th year now. That's a long time. No, wait. We're going into 13? No,
12.
Yeah. Going into our 12th year of publication. But still, 100 podcasts. It's a huge deal for us, and I'm quite proud of that show. Personally, I think that was the show. I mean, I don't think, Chad, you were even in that show, were you?
No.
And I was barely in it.
Mm-hmm.
But all the people who contributed and the way it was I'll take credit for this, the way it was edited together.
Yeah.
I think it just came out. That's the one show that I could point to and say, that's what we were doing.
Mm-hmm.
In 2006, that's what the podcast was really about. So,
but you know what was funny was, on the other side of that, we were, you know, we were doing the mini podcast at that point too, and you broke up that like hour and a half long conversation that the three of us had in my hotel room the night before, and I mean, just going back and listening to those, and other than splitting it in certain parts, it was pretty much unedited.
Yeah, it was completely unedited,
right?
And but you know, that was really a precursor to what we're doing now.
Yeah,
right.
I think that night after we recorded that and listened to it, we thought, yeah, that's kind of nice having three of us.
Mm-hmm.
And especially that Guy doesn't always agree with me, and Chad doesn't always agree with me, and I don't agree with them, and they don't agree with each other. We need that as a...
Well, I usually don't agree with myself.
Yeah, me neither. So let's look ahead. 2007, I made a couple of notes about what I think maybe, I don't know, what's going to be the big story. Now, obviously, we don't know what's going to be released at Macworld. We really can't say what the big stories of 2007 are going to be, but I can make some educated guesses. Some people are saying, of course, like we were talking about earlier, the downfall of Steve Jobs, that this really could lead to some severe consequences of the stock fraud.
Right.
Will it?
No, I don't think it will. I don't really look at it as a stock fraud. You know, Apple certainly made some errors with backdating stock options, but what's going to save Steve Jobs with this is that he didn't exercise the options. So I think at worst is what's going to happen. He's going to get fined, and, you know, I mean, it could be a hefty fine, you know, in the millions of dollars. When you have that kind of money, it's like, okay, you know, I don't go to jail. I give you these millions of dollars, and life goes on.
Yeah, well, we'll see. I think the big news of 2007 is going to be release of macOS 10.5. That's going to be the big thing
probably next year.
Yeah. I'm sure that ITV will be released, and it's going to be a huge, but for the average Mac user, for everybody listening to the show, I think when Apple releases 10.5, that's going to have more of a significant impact than any other event that happens in the next 12 months. Agree? Disagree?
Oh, I agree. I think if they can make things like the time machine work, and work well, that'll be a huge step.
Yeah, I think so. Guy?
I really think, you know, and of course we don't know exactly what it's going to be. I still think ITV is going to be the big story, because I don't think that this is going to be the only hardware that Apple releases along these lines. I think we're just seeing the small steps right now, and that we're going to see more stuff from Apple, you know, with an Apple logo that sits in your living room. I'm not talking about TVs, because, you know, there's no money in that right now. You know, LCD and plasma TVs are coming way, way down in price, and Apple's not going to jump into that. We also have, maybe sooner or later, eventually, the iPhone.
iPhone is another one that I was selecting as a possible big news item.
My problem is that I think there's so much hype that's been put on top of the iPhone. It would have to be a real evolutionary jump in that.
Well, how hard would that be? In this case, it's not so much the hardware, because there's plenty of phones out there where the hardware is really, really solid.
Yeah.
Where almost every single phone that I've seen and almost every single phone that I've used has lacked is in the user interface. It's just so damn hard to figure out what the hell it is you want to do with the damn thing.
And well, if anybody can do a user interface.
Right.
Oh, yeah, Apple.
True, but it's got to be really, really slick to hit the average guy and not just the diehard Apple cultists like ourselves.
Another well, it, at first off, when it gets released, it's going to be just the Apple guys buying it.
Well, it depends on if they bill it as an iPod or an Apple product. If they bill it as an iPod type of device, it won't just be the Mac users. When they release it, it has to work with Windows as well as Macs.
Yeah, but that's going to depend on the price point too. I mean, if you're looking at $400 to $500 for an iPod with a phone built in, then yeah, you're going to have a hard time getting people to spend that kind of money.
Well, and the other thing is, how do you handle the service? Who's going to do the service for them?
And that's an open phone.
Yeah, we'll have to find out what happens, and we don't even know if this is a real product or what.
Right.
Another big story is going to be even tighter integration between Windows applications within the Mac OS, possibly by Parallels, VMware Fusion, or Apple itself. That's going to be, it's going to be a continually important big story for Mac users and PC users switching over to the Mac platform. I see that taking the next quantum leap,
mm-hmm.
that's really going to be a big deal in 2007.
Yeah.
Agree?
I agree.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And we're looking at, we were talking about this. I think we're looking at a time when running Windows apps on your Mac, you won't need Windows.
Exactly.
You'll just double click it, and you may even have to have some type of maybe even something from Microsoft that's running in the background to handle some of the stuff that the Mac OS doesn't have built into it, the DirectX stuff or what have you. But it'll
good luck
just
with that.
Yeah, it'll just open up and you'll see it as a Mac application.
Probably the other two big software releases coming up this next year. Microsoft Office for Mac coming out this next year. That's going to be huge news. And probably even bigger is Adobe Photo or Adobe Creative Suite 3.
Mm-hmm.
That's going to be, those two releases are huge. And
you know what? Go ahead.
No, it's go for it.
Oh, I was going to say, I think you're going to find that the moment that Adobe releases CS3, there's going to be a huge jump in Mac sales from all these professionals that are basically just waiting for it.
Well, not immediately. Most creative companies will deploy it to one machine, test it for a month or two, make sure that it's stable enough, and then deploy it company-wide. So mm-hmm. it doesn't happen immediately. But yes, you will see a lot more Mac Pros being sold probably halfway through this year. I think we're closer to Creative Suite 3 than most people think we are. I think
they're saying it's going to come out in what, spring?
Well, they never really said when, but I think we're going to get the announcement during the Steve Jobs keynote, and I think it's going to be available within weeks, if not months, but weeks. Mm-hmm. I think by the middle of February, you'll be able to order it. That's my prediction. As far as Microsoft Office 07, I don't see that happening until probably early fall, honestly.
Yeah.
The other big story could be maybe a real video iPod. I mean, that's been going around rumors forever and ever.
Not an iPod with video.
No, it would be a new device that would be a supplement to the iPod. I don't know. We'll see. So that one's been around forever. Or an iPod with new capabilities, such as maybe wireless headphones, GPS built in. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of different directions Apple could take the iPod. And let's be quite honest, it needs a refresher. Something needs to happen with the iPod to make it hip, cool, and get us to buy the next generation.
Yeah.
Because you quite know, it's honestly, funny. You just said GPS.
You just said GPS. If they came out with a 4-inch screen with built-in GPS and you could watch movies on it, I'd be right in line to buy one.
I would buy two of them. I seriously would buy two of them, one for my car and one for my wife's car.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe even one for Chad. I don't know. That's how impressed I would be.
I would put two and put one by each ear.
I've been calling, even before this year, last year on this show, mm-hmm. I've been calling for a GPS-enabled iPod.
Yes, you have.
And I think, I don't know why it hasn't happened yet. GPS is starting to really take off.
Yep.
And the iPod is already really taken off.
What could be better than geocaching to your own tunes?
That's right. You know, the Garmin iPod. There you go.
The other thing that the iPod could use is something that Microsoft tried to do, but they did it so badly that it's worthless. Is
sharing music.
Wireless? No, not sharing music. I'm talking about Wi-Fi capability. But instead of going from one iPod to the other, because none of the content providers are going to allow you to do that without some kind of, you know, three plays and then the damn thing disintegrates. And so that makes it worthless. Where it could be really, really cool would be wirelessly syncing to your computer at your house, would be wirelessly syncing via a Wi-Fi hotspot somewhere. Yep.
That's
the
something
iTunes
that
store.
I've talked about for a while as well. Why can't I pull into my driveway and I'm within 50 feet of my airport base station? Why doesn't it sync? Why can't I do that now? I've been saying that for quite a while as well. Another idea for the iPod,
access
to the iTunes music store from the iPod itself.
That would be smooth.
I think that would kill this whole welcome to the social thing that Microsoft has going on with the Zune.
Mm-hmm.
I think that would be awful, awful cool. So that's some of the things that we're looking forward to in 2007. Obviously, we don't have a crystal ball, and this is pretty much guesswork on our part. Mm-hmm. But I think it's probably, from everything
it's
that
doable.
We've seen, it's all doable, definitely.
Yep.
We'll be asking our iPod, where do I go? Instead of the whole Tom thing. So where we're going is off the air. We will be back next year, 2007. We'll have one more podcast before the Macworld Expo. Actually, we'll be recording that next Thursday. Usually we release the podcast on Monday. We're releasing a little bit early this week simply because we don't want to drop it out on New Year's Day.
Mm-hmm.
And we also didn't want to drop one out on Christmas Day, a couple, you know, for last week. So we're kind of right into that sweet spot where we're going to release this show tomorrow on Friday. And then we'll be back with another show next Friday that Chad, Guy, and I myself will record next Thursday. And it will be our last show before the Macworld Expo. It will be the first show of 2007. And I have no idea what we're going to talk about yet.
Well, you know, as far as last week goes, what Tim isn't telling you is that he was very, very sick. And so I got together with Chad and I attempted, and it was not a good attempt, but I did attempt to record a podcast. I was using Ubercaster, and it's a program that's still not ready for prime time. Cool idea, but still not quite there. And so, then I got together with my brother Larry via Skype, and it was just a disaster.
Live and learn.
Yeah, live and learn. Live and
indeed.
Learn.
So thanks for listening to our segment. Up next is David Cohen's Fenestration, and we'll see you guys next week.
See ya.
Bye-bye.
Hello, my name is David Cohen and I'm the London Bureau Chief for MyMac.com. Welcome to Fenestration, my guide to using a Mac in a Windows world.
Now, welcome back to the show.
If you're a regular listener to Fenestration, you may recall a comment I made a few weeks ago regarding the Mac Business Unit's decision not to include support for Visual Basic in the next version of Microsoft Office for Macintosh, which is due in the middle of 2007. To quickly re-summarise my views from that show, I am concerned that the decision not to include Visual Basic support in the next version of Microsoft Office is going to produce a divergence in the product line between the Windows and the Mac version. Obviously, it reduces compatibility, because macros recorded or created in Visual Basic on the Windows side, when run under the Macintosh version of Microsoft Office, won't run macros because the support for VB won't be there. Now, it transpires another issue has arisen from the Mac Business Unit, which causes similar sorts of concern. The issue arises again from compatibility between Office 2007 for Windows, which has just been released, and the Mac version of Office that's due next year. Office 2007 employs a new document format. It's what Microsoft terms an open format. By that I mean it's open by Microsoft standards, but probably not as open as the open source community would like. Effectively, the format is XML-based and is completely non-proprietary in terms of Microsoft is prepared to let people read and disseminate the detailed contents of these XML files, rather than in the past, Microsoft might allow access to these files and allow you to read them, but only to certain parts of them. The XML file effectively is a flat text file which contains all the details of the document. And using an appropriate XML schema, you can actually access all the various features of, say, a Word document saved in this format. And you can actually add your own features as well. So it's a much more friendly situation for Office users than has existed in the past, where a .doc format might be completely closed and only Microsoft might be capable of reading it effectively in their own application. This should help eliminate some of the incompatibilities that have occurred between different versions of Office products in the past. For example, if you opened a .doc file in OpenOffice, while the .doc file will be opened and read by the OpenOffice Word Processor program, all of the formatting features that were applied by Microsoft from the original version of Word might not be available, and OpenOffice's ability not to read those features correctly might mean that you get some document corruption. This can occasionally occur even between different versions of Office on Windows itself, let alone moving Office between Windows, say, and the Macintosh. So great. Why have I got reason to complain about this on Fenestration? Well, the problem is this. Obviously, these formats are brand new, and if you take one of these documents and try and open it on a Macintosh version of Office, say the most recent version, Office 2004, you won't be able to open it. Now, this situation also exists if you take that same document saved in Office 2007 and try and open it in Word 2003 on the Windows side. However, as Office 2007 for Windows has been launched, Microsoft has also made available a Service Pack plugin that can be run by Office 2003, Office XP, or even Office 2000 users on the Windows platform, and will allow them to read and open Office 2007 XML files. These XML files are the default save format for Office 2007. My area of concern is the fact that a similar converter to allow these files to be opened by Macintosh Office 2004 users will not be made available by the Macintosh Business Unit at Microsoft for another 3 to 4 months. Now, in my view, this is rather unacceptable. The Macintosh Business Unit now blogs quite regularly on the web, so you can read their thoughts around their various activities. And obviously they use their blogs as a mouthpiece for actually explaining some of the decisions made by the business unit. Now, in this case, what they've said is that it's important for them to make sure that the converters they write for the Macintosh are stable and are working with the final version of Office 2007 as was shipped. In other words, they support the actual final lockdown feature set of Office 2007 rather than some code that was actually in flux while the converters were being written. And I can appreciate all of that, except for the fact that the Windows converters are available now, and presumably the people writing those had to deal with the same issues. You can't help getting away from the concern that the Microsoft Business Unit for Macintosh Development over at Redmond is understaffed or under-resourced. If that's not the case, and in fact they've got plenty of resources and plenty of staff, then you have to be concerned that their business priorities are shifting, and those business priorities are around what's best for Microsoft, rather than what's best for Macintosh users who use Microsoft. Product delay from Microsoft developers is never a good thing. It's taken them 5 years to get Vista out of the door, for example. So any time they introduce a delay or say that there's going to be a set date sometime in the future by which time they will have some coding finished, it's a cause for concern. Now, I don't think this issue is going to directly affect most of us users straight away, because my Office 2007, while it does save by default into these XML file formats, obviously most people aren't running Office 2007 at the moment. They're running older versions. So I suspect that most Windows users who install Office 2007 will immediately go and change the defaults so that in fact they create Office 2003 compatible files, which can be read fine on the Macintosh. So from an actual functional operational issue, I don't believe there's much of an issue there, and probably won't be for the next 2 to 3 months. However, I am a little bit concerned that the Macintosh Business Unit decisions being made at the moment, as I say, are rather Microsoft-focused and not really very user-focused. They accept they're going to take some flak for these decisions, and yet they keep on making them. The end result, one worries, is that the Microsoft version of Office for Macintosh that ships next year will be substantially different in terms of features and compatibility than the version of Office shipping for Windows at the moment, which is Office 2007. This sort of product line divergence is going to be a real headache. One of the things that us users have relied on, if we're running a Macintosh in a Windows environment, is to be able to freely exchange files between Windows and Mac users. And Microsoft is, what I would argue, along with Photoshop, probably the principal bridging application to allow that to happen. If file formats start to change and features start to diverge, that compatibility is not as robust as it used to be, and that's a bad thing for Microsoft Macintosh users. Now, there is a possibility that, in fact, these sorts of actions are indicating a shift in Microsoft's strategy towards the Macintosh. There could be a variety of reasons for this. Microsoft's income and revenue streams are changing as people change the way they operate their computers. They're not upgrading even on the PC side as frequently as they used to. And obviously, it's going to take a good long while for people to move from XP to Vista. So Microsoft needs to understand exactly where its revenue streams are coming from and where the Macintosh fits into that product portfolio. Now, I suspect that what we will find is the next version of Microsoft Office for Macintosh will be the last one. We probably won't see a revised version in the future. Now, that could be a cause for definite concern, because if Office for Windows continues to be developed and Office for Macintosh doesn't, then obviously we're going to be left behind, and that compatibility I'm talking about, and the ability to share files using a bridging application, won't be there for Macintosh users. However, I find myself wondering whether Microsoft are looking to take a different approach. It occurs to me that rather than having separate business units developing the same applications or types of applications for multiple platforms, it would be much more sensible for Microsoft to actually develop the same application for multiple platforms. What do I mean by that? Well, what I've got in mind is a situation where instead of developing two versions of Microsoft Office, they develop just one, the Windows version. Where would that leave the Macintosh user who wants to run Office? Well, I don't believe that Microsoft would see it in their interest to leave that user out in the cold. Now, there's a solution like Parallels which allows you to run Windows virtually on a Macintosh. But obviously, as we've already seen with Virtual PC, Microsoft aren't interested in competing in that space. They were the first people to walk away from it and announce they weren't going to develop Virtual PC for the Intel platform. And that was probably a smart thing for them to do, because while they probably could have turned out a version of Virtual PC that worked just as well as Parallels, they wouldn't have had it on the market by now. They probably would have taken until the middle of next year to actually get it out. And in the meantime, Parallels would have taken their market away from them. So the investment in that application would have been a waste. No, what I think Microsoft could do, and I'm not saying they will do this, but what they could do is instead develop a version of the Windows APIs that can be installed on top of OS X and will allow Windows applications to run natively under OS X calling those APIs. Now, that sort of application is already available for Macintosh. CodeWeaver's crossover Mac development, which is currently in beta, does exactly what I've just said. It recreates the Windows APIs and allows Windows applications to access those APIs and run natively on the OS X desktop as if they were running under Windows. The issue with the CodeWeaver's product is that, of course, they don't have access to Microsoft's intellectual property, so they've had to recreate those Windows APIs. That's the work that the Wine application emulation environment does, and that's the work that they've based their product on. Now, recreating an API from scratch without being able to see the source code is much more difficult than actually porting your API if you already have the source code. So what Microsoft could well do is actually create a compatibility layer for Windows applications running on OS X, and then they could take their complete existing application portfolio and allow that to run on OS X natively, calling those Windows APIs. So that would give them one development for the Macintosh they would need, and then the rest of their product base would run just as it does on the Windows side, which would mean they'd only need one Office team, they'd only need one Exchange team, they'd only need one Microsoft Bob team, whatever application they want to be developing. They could develop for Windows, and all they'd need to do is ensure that they complied with the Windows API guidelines to ensure that that product would then work on the Macintosh under the Microsoft Windows API for Macintosh, which I'm sure they would call a snappier name than that. Now, I've got no inside knowledge. I've got no guarantee that this is what Microsoft are thinking. But I hope that that's what they're doing, bearing in mind some of the issues and problems we're seeing around Macintosh compatibility coming out of the Macintosh business unit over at Microsoft at the moment. Time will tell what happens.
Hey, thanks for listening to today's podcast. We'll be here next time. Keep the emails coming in and be sure to subscribe.
That's going to do it for this session. As always, questions or comments to davidcohen@mymac.com. Until the next time. We'll
delighted to have Sharon Zardetto-Aker as our guest today, talking about real-world Mac OS X fonts, industrial strength techniques, and the publisher is Peach Pit Press. Sharon, welcome to Book Bites Live on the MyMac.com podcast.
Well, hi. Thanks for having me.
Please tell us about how this book is similar or different from the Take Control previous editions, and more importantly, what the difference is in preparing a book for physical press versus preparing it for an e-book or a digital book.
Yeah, I found there were a lot of interesting differences. But at first, I just want to say that I wouldn't refer to the Take Control ebook as the previous publication or the previous edition. They are one and the same, actually. And so whoever would prefer a print book can look to the Peach Pit presentation. And if you like working with ebooks, then you can go to takecontrolbooks.com and get that. One of the differences is that, right up front, is that the printed book is actually two books in one, because we have a problem on the PDF end of having things that are too large, not only for the user who wouldn't have to download such a large item, but just processing a large PDF with hundreds of links becomes a problem. So on the ebook end, we've got Take Control of Fonts and Take Control of Font Problems, and those two are put together in the print book. In general, the difference between preparing a book for print and one for, what should we say, one for screen, the ebook, has a lot to do, first of all, with the resolution that you get in a printed book versus, of course, the resolution of your screen. So there are some of the obvious things, such as the size of the type. And I have to say that Tanya Angst, who's one half of Tidbits, the Take Control publishers, has done an incredibly wonderful job in designing something that works on the screen very well. And then if you want to print it, you print it two up. And what is nicely readable on the screen, a 12 to 14 point type, is also readable from a printer when you print two up, which gives you, about two-thirds of the size. But that's the obvious thing. But there are trickle-down problems from the whole resolution thing. So, for instance, if you're doing a picture and you want to do call-outs, little lines, labeling, this, that, and the other thing, you can do that in a print book. But on an e-book, you can't, because the text that would be describing whatever the arrow's pointing to would just be too small to read on the screen.
Okay.
And then the pictures themselves, in the e-book, we have a rather narrow, not philosophically, of course, but a narrow physical approach, so that the pictures, you can't do full screen dumps that someone can actually see. So you have to think differently as an author when you're going to prepare a picture and refer to it, when you know you can't do the whole screen, or else it'll be very tiny. And if you want the reader to see some of the elements of that screen rather than just getting an overview of what a window looks like.
The MyMac.com perspective, since we're in close communication with the Take Control people as well as the Peach Pit people, we're delighted that your book exists in both formats, and we know our readers and our listeners are definitely aware of the Take Control series as well as the Real World series from Peach Pit.
But yes, they work nicely together.
Going back to the content of the book, you make a big deal about the fonts in Tiger and in general the fonts in OS X. In Tiger and in OS X, why are fonts stored in so many different places?
Right. First of all, let me say it's my job to make a big deal of fonts, right? No. The fonts are a big deal. My job was to try and clear that up. But let me just go back and say for a moment about the ebook versus the paper book. The thing that that I found the most interesting is the reader experience, because it's so different, besides linking instead of saying see page 72, is that when you're looking at a physical book, you know there's a picture coming up on, say, the right-hand page while you're looking at the left-hand page. That's not something you know when you're looking at a screenful at a time, which is, in effect, a single page. And we wind up having to link a lot more often, saying, in figure 9, as you'll see in figure 9. And while I do find it awkward occasionally as a writer to do those kinds of references so often, it becomes very important because the reader can't you know, see ahead and know there's a picture coming up explaining this. And that was, I think, the most subtle difference that I had to learn to work with. But let's go on to the fonts. And, well, you know, the easy answer, why are they stored in so many different places, is because Unix, the underlying environment, requires certain structures. And so they have to be like that. But that's not a very informational kind of answer either. One is for the classic environment, which, of course, won't be with us much longer since it's not supported on the Intel Macs. Those fonts can be different from the ones that OS X uses. You can still use certain ones in the classic environment that won't work in the OS X environment. So that's one category. So we can almost ignore that at this point. And then the fact that Macs are designed to be shared. So there are fonts that any user of the computer can see, and then there are fonts that are private to each user. So that makes sense, too. So all of a sudden, three different places make sense. Then you've got the ones that the system uses. This one doesn't make a lot of sense to me. I think those things should be hidden from the user. If they're required for the system, like Lucida Grand and Helvetica and so on, I think you shouldn't be able to get at them at all. So that one doesn't make all that much sense, but it's not so hard to understand that the computer needs stuff to draw dialog boxes and so on. And then finally, something else that's really nice is different applications can have their fonts that are private to the applications, or in Adobe's case, all the applications that go with that vendor. And it's actually a very good approach, and the only problem with this whole approach and this application-only font thing is that it's just not clear. So it's not user-friendly. There's not there's only a couple lines of documentation in the help system or on the Apple site. So what could be a logical and easily understandable structure, just people were floundering around literally for years because, you know, why are they here? What's going on? So it was the presentation of the whole structure, I think, that Apple really drop the ball on that one.
Yes. Well, hopefully that will get better, not worse.
Yes, we can only hope.
And you make a big deal about something called Font Book. What is Apple's Font Book, and why do we need to pay attention to it?
Well, by big deal, yes, I devote a full chapter to it. By necessity, because it's the font manager in OS X. It lets you. It's what controls everything when you want to add a font, when you want to keep fonts around, but you don't necessarily want 300 of them in your menu at any given time, so you can disable them, which just means they're temporarily not available to the Mac. And I pay it a lot of attention because, I always try and write about things that come with the system. And no matter what I'm writing, I'll say, well, if you're just using, you know, what you got with your computer, here's how to do it. But if you're going to buy a utility, you might try it this way. But it's always, I think, very important to work with the Apple system software because that's what every user has. And why should they always have to buy, you know, new stuff? It's not good enough for professionals. Not that it can't handle a couple thousand fonts, because I actually did it and I didn't really see much of a slowdown. I should say I didn't see a slowdown at all, to be fair.
Nice.
But fontaholics and professionals, they need better font management. For instance, one of the crux of font management in if you're doing layout is you have to have fonts open automatically when you open a document that used, you know, fonts ABC, even if they're not already turned on by default. And Fontbook doesn't do that. And although it's a glaring omission, that wouldn't be one of the things I would expect to see added to it, say, in Leopard. So,
you spent a lot of time near the rear of the book talking about troubleshooting and maintenance. And do those chapters apply only to the hardcore fontaholics and graphics and desktop publishing professionals?
Well, I guess, you know, the first answer is it also applies to softcore fontaholics, by which I mean anyone who, you know, adds a few fonts here and there. I'd say that 80% of the troubleshooting, maybe 80% of it would really be for people who are just adding lots and lots of fonts. And by that I mean, what do I mean by that? Probably more than 100 more than come with the system, so you can learn how to juggle them. But, you know, everybody runs into Microsoft Word saying, oh, this font is corrupt. Oop, the next one is corrupt. Oop, the next one is corrupt. And you can do that without adding any fonts to your system at all. So The troubleshooting chapter is mostly for people who use a lot of fonts, but of course there's always some stuff in there that anybody might run into.
What are those cute little red symbols and those little adjacent identifications representative of in your screenshots, those little red thingamabobs?
When I did the ebook and I was working with Tanya and saw the format for all the ebooks, I said, please, 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 I want to do this little thing, which is not, you know, in the template. It's not the way things were done in the other Take Control books. And to her credit, she said, yes, that would be fun. That would be cool. And what that is I tried any place I could whenever I was doing a little more than a screenshot. So, for instance, I needed to number things or put letters by them or put arrows. I used symbols that were in the fonts that came with the system because so many people don't realize you've got apples. You do have apples, but you have numbers and letters and arrows buried in all sorts of fonts. And in order to show that, to encourage people to look into their fonts, the character set, and also to get people more comfortable with ID numbers, there's the Unicode font ID system where each character gets a certain number. There's something called a GID. And I just wanted people to start realizing it's not a big deal that different characters have numbers. So an A is 65, and an arrow might be 237. So I just labeled all the things in my figures using different font characters, and then I said what IDs they were in case people wanted to go look at them or use them for something.
Well, here at Book Bites Live at the MyMac.com podcast, we're very impressed with real-world Mac OS X fonts by Sharon Zardetto-Aker. And here, live on our podcast, we are going to award you our highest rating of 5 out of 5. But I do say, if you're serious about fonts, you'll definitely get the most value out of this book. If you've never done anything with fonts, just skim the book, because I don't want you to break out into hives at first. And we thank you so much for joining us on the podcast, Sharon, and we hope to meet you again. Do you have any projects coming up that would be interesting? Listeners and readers.
First, I just thank you for inviting me, and thank you for the 5-star rating. I feel like a top hotel. I'm working more on another Take Control book on general interface stuff in the Finder. You wouldn't think we'd really need that at this stage, but even people who've been with the Mac a long time, OS X is significantly different. And on another front, I started a regular column for geek.com, and I just find it very interesting to note that the week I started with geek.com, my son started at hippieshop.com. So the cosmic balance is still great.
Terrific. Well, it's always a pleasure to be in touch with you, and welcome back to Writing About the Mac. We've missed long time.
Thanks for downloading the MyMac.com podcast. You can subscribe to this podcast at our RSS feed at MyMac.com or by visiting the iTunes Music Store's podcast section. Please send all feedback to MyMacPodcast@gmail.com. And thanks for listening to the MyMac.com podcast.